after October 7th, had they gone to the UN and said, we were attacked, this is wrong, they committed a crime, here's what happened. And even with all the lies we now know are provable lies, you know how much harder it would have been to get past those lies if they had introduced it in a legal way and then it was discussed and then they went forward? My point is they would have never had to ask for support again. Already had insurmountable support. That would have solidified it, in my opinion, forever. Instead, they went full Zionist and full genocide and immediately went to murdering children and everything they've done since, which then woke everybody up. All these average people are like, you can't just look, there's no narrative you can place over all the things we see and 15,000 children and everything else we see. And that you go, oh, that's why it makes sense. That doesn't exist. There's no narrative that makes us feel okay. And they can't come back from that, you know? And I think that's important. Now, there really are so many other angles that are important to get into, but I think that's a good understanding of what's going on, you know? And I think there's a lot of allegations of racism and anti-Semitism that get thrown over the top of this when the truth is what I'm doing. I think a lot of us, I'm fighting for Jewish people. I'm fighting for Muslims. I'm fighting for Israelis and Palestinians and anybody who is being suppressed and taken advantage of by power structures. And right now, Jewish people are rapidly recognizing that Zionism has been doing that for 75 years.
If you've been following recent developments, you're likely aware of the ongoing transformation in the global economy. The BRICS nations are actively advocating for the replacement of the dollar as the world's reserve currency, and an increasing number of countries are aligning with their efforts. Concurrently, the stability of the Western banking system is facing unprecedented challenges, reaching a level of fragility not seen since the 2008 financial crisis. The reputable Weiss Research Group, known for accurately forecasting bank failures with 99.3% accuracy since 2008, now anticipates a substantial risk of over 4,000 banks facing vulnerabilities, with a fourth of them on the brink of imminent failure. According to their data, all the experts are predicting a major economic collapse more impactful than the crash of 1929. Historically, precious metals have proven to be resilient assets during such economic uncertainties. Now is an opportune moment to consider acquiring gold and silver to safeguard your family's financial well-being. For the most reliable service and the best prices on gold and silver, I recommend Miles Franklin at info@milesfranklin.com. When you contact them, mention Sarah sent me. It ensures you receive the best service and pricing available in the country. That's a guarantee from them to me. Take proactive steps now to secure your assets and protect your loved ones. Contact info@milesfranklin.com and let them know Sarah sent you.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. I have Ryan Christian coming to the program. I've been wanting to interview him for a while. He does really great work, but he runs The Last American Vagabond, and they're under attack. I mean, he has lawsuits. He has all sorts of things. I'm going to have a Give, Send, Go that you can go and you can support his lawsuits, his organization. They have a group of independent journalists. They're suppressed everywhere. But we're going to talk about Zionism and what's going on in Gaza, what's going on in Ukraine. He's very passionate about it, but he's very well studied. These guys really work hard to get to the truth and the facts. Now, is it all right? I don't know, but he's the first one to tell you, don't take my word for it. You go and study. You critically think through this. That's what we need, is people who can critically think and figure out what's really going on. I'm going to provide you data and information, and then you take that, talk amongst your friends, talk when you go out at your dinner table, wherever. That's where change really occurs, is in the local communities where people talk about things. But he provides so much information, and they're under attack. I'm under attack. We're all under attack. And he's going to explain that. But we're first going to talk about Zionism and what they're doing in Gaza, what's really going on, how Jewish people are not Zionists. Zionism and Jewish is not the same thing. And it's just not fair to mix that. And I think Jewish people are going to suffer for that. And they know it. There's a lot of people within the Jewish community that says, wait a minute, I am not that. And I do not want to be connected to that. And I mean, this is what's going on. But Zionism is being exposed for what it is. And I think it's going to be, he says this in the show, and I agree with him, that it's going to be like Nazi Germany was, where for decades after that, and even today, where people learn in history what happened and how bad this was and how it created the, you know, millions of people dying and just the attitudes of Nazism, is going to be the same thing with Zionism. And people are going to be informed and learning about how bad this is. And we're going to talk up, tie it into what's going on in Ukraine and all around the world. And I hope he's right. I hope Zionism does die out. There'll always be factions, right? There'll always be people that want that. But overall, people need to become aware of how this is just a horrible regime for war and dominance and control, and has nothing to do with what's good for people. So that's what we talk about. I hope you watch this whole thing. I hope you share it far and wide. It's important that we talk about these things and that these discussions happen. Okay, before I get into this, I want to talk to you about the MitoCure RX. People know about methylene blue. It's just been taking the internet by storm on how it is helping people with upping your energy levels. And it's been very effective for that. But the problem is it's temporary. Once you stop taking it, you don't feel it anymore. It's only while you take it that you have higher energy. And so Ian Mitchell, scientists and Wizard Labs, came up with some ingredients that they added to it so that it promotes mitochondria turnover so that your cells are healthier. So as you're taking this, you get the immediate boost of the energy from methylene blue, and then you get the mitochondria turnover that creates healthier, more energetic cells. So over time, you're not addicted to this darn thing. And that's what happens. Methylene blue is really expensive. This is a little less expensive. It actually, I think they're selling for $89.99, which it's expensive, but that's compared to like $150 elsewhere. They're really trying to get it to be less for people to at least try it. And then you don't have to take it all the time. Once you get your energy up, your mitochondria turns over, you're feeling better, you can stop taking it for a while. And then maybe you take it as maintenance here and there, ongoing. But it's a much better approach. Instead of just going after a Band-Aid fix that's temporary, you're actually trying to get to a source problem. That's why I love this stuff. Okay, so you can buy at sarahwestall.com under shop or with the link below. Okay, let's get into this really important. I think this is an important conversation that I have with Ryan Christian. Hi, Ryan. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate the invite.
I've been wanting to interview you for a while. I've been following you on what's going on in Gaza and on other things for quite some time. Your reporting is very passionate, but you are reporting truth that other people are not, at least many people are not. Before we get into this, can you talk a little bit about why you're so passionate about what's going on in Israel, Gaza, and other topics around the world that the mass media just does not cover?
Well, one of the reasons I even got into this all these years ago was just out of a sense of need, passion, empathy for people that are suffering and are not acknowledged as suffering, or don't have a voice and don't have, the ability to draw attention to what they're dealing with. And more than ever today, people are becoming aware of just how much that is happening. And sadly, at the direct involvement or directly because of the very people standing up screaming they're fighting for the opposite of those things, rules-based international orders and so on, right? And along when I first got into this, I had that moment that a lot of us did, where I was watching corporate media and was still under the naive impression that these people were trying to inform you, and I realized, I'm like, wait a minute, whether it's the Fox, CNN, or any other dynamic, the difference of the two sides, and I'm going, well, they're both reporting the same story, and they're both telling me diametrically opposite facts about the same story. And I'm thinking, like, that was, we all had that moment. And I was like, well, how is that possible? Somebody's lying. And, it sort of made me realize that, okay, there's really a problem here. And the more that you dive into it, the more that you realize, specifically back to the main topic you brought up about Palestine, is that these people have been suffering for a very, very, very long time. And it's insulting to us that we pretend all of the lies that are circulated, like provable, easily verifiable lies about history, about any number of things, that are just disregarded. And I felt that somebody needed to stand up. And I'm realizing, most people have this mindset that it's like, well, there's people that have those jobs and, they're my betters or the experts are going to speak up. And my point was like, well, I don't see that. You got these corporate media sides acting like they're filling that role, and there's nobody there saying it. So I felt obligated as an individual, as a civilian. I'm not classically trained in any of these things, to step up and do what I thought was right. And it's always been, the whole premise for what I'm doing. You know, it comes from a place of empathy and compassion for people that need people like us to stand up for them and fight for them. And I'm really truly seeing a change in the world right now because of that. And one thing I constantly say on the show is, you know, we need to act as we want people to act, you know, the same classic concept, you know, go out and do the small things for people, open doors, whatever else, like just be that person and it will change people around you. It's like, it's a ripple effect, you know, and we see it, whether it's in independent media or just in our daily lives. And I'm really hoping that we can get that momentum going because, you know, it's amazing. We're at a time where those things are regarded as almost like useless or naive or unmanly or, you know, whatever it is. It's like, we need compassion. We need empathy. I really believe
that. That's right. And, you know, I push back on Christians because I grew up in a very Christian environment. And like, you have to ignore all the teaching. This is important that people understand that because there's control structures in our society. You have to ignore almost all the other teachings in Christianity to support this Israel Gaza situation because they say, you know, you need to support Israel. I'm like, well, they're not talking about the state of Israel. They're talking about people. And you have to ignore, if you have to ignore almost all the other teachings in order to support this, then you need to take a step back and say, okay, is this really what I'm supposed to be doing? And I think there's just so many control structures and people need to have some critical thinking skills to get past this.
I agree. And I think that the Israel Gaza situation in and of itself has become this moment of awakening for a lot of people to see things that they never really wanted to see or ever thought were present, you know. And it really is a powerful time where people are suddenly just, and it's uncomfortable, cognitive dissonance and all that. Like, it's, we get it. It's an uncomfortable thing to recognize you've believed and you know, in like folded into who you are as a person, things that are completely baseless and not true. But I think it's a good moment to recognize that this is how real positive change happens. And, you know, analogies, darker before the dawn kind of conversation, like we're watching people react, power structures that are desperate to maintain that power. And they're going to make your life uncomfortable because they want to keep this thing in the way that they want the status quo. But I think we're seeing this change and it's going to be inevitable. I just think we need to make sure we kind of try to look past party lines and any other kind of arbitrary blocks and work towards something positive in that way. And, you know, I think that's what they're trying to fight to force us back into in a lot of ways, even bigger than just the Israel conversation.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. They want to force us into that dichotomy. Now, what is because the World Economic Forum, all these, they want a reset too. They want to tear down our society and rebuild it to whatever agenda they have. We are seeing things breaking down, which are positive. How do we reconstruct it in a way that is pro-human, that is, we don't want them controlling us as everything breaks down. We want us to keep the good parts and then also build something that's more pro-human. How do, because you say you're seeing things change. So how do we do that?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I'll immediately shout out is Derek Brose, who is a writer for The Last American Vagabond, but also runs theconsciousresistance.com. He has started a yearly event called The Greater Reset. And the point is about trying to highlight that, you know, yes, there are problems. And this is one of the most common things I see with the two-party illusion is that you end up in this position where it's all or nothing. Right? It's extreme on both sides, and the truth is usually somewhere in the middle. So the point is with sustainability, let's say, buzzword today, right? And the point is, well, is sustainability bad? Well, hardly. We should be striving for sustainability. What they're fighting for is not sustainability. They're using that word over the top of something that's very different, right? And so then, but what the problem is that people, largely on the right-wing side of the conversation, end up arguing that sustainability is a bad thing and fighting against it. And in many cases, you know, you are fighting against what they're claiming it is, but you also end up fighting against people that are truly fighting for real sustainable change and you know, practices. And so my point is that in this process, in the greater reset, his entire focus is about showing you, yes, we do have problems. We're clearly destroying the planet. And many cases, that's our governments, the ones pretending the climate change narrative is true, are the ones actually destroying our planet with all sorts of military burn pits and whatever else they're doing around the world. It's obvious. But obviously, the climate change narrative is a complete, in my opinion, which I'm sure your audience probably agrees with, is a very clear manipulation. But the point is that we can find solutions in a very human-centric direction that they can solve these problems, not the leaning into the groups that have caused the problems to solve the problems themselves or more technology. The point is to lean into more you know, sustainable concepts in the more real sense of it. And, you know, he talks about things like this where he's written articles about how, you know, the concept they say is you'll own nothing and you've never been happier kind of thing. He goes, I own a homestead. I own, you know, the opposite of, I forget how he phrased it, but, and I've never been happier, you know, and showing you that society can thrive in ways that are contradictory to what they're trying to show you is the only solution forward. So, you know, technocracy, nanotechnology, mRNA platforms, you know, all this stuff. And it, in fact, we're learning very rapidly. These things are, in fact, counterintuitive to human species, really. And I think that's what we need to start leaning into is practical, productive, human-centric, organic, you know, holistic kind of solutions. And I mean, we can go in any number of any of them, and we could talk about ones that I think are obvious to people, you know, like we're talking about is you could find solutions that benefit, you know, the problems with like we're talking about destroying the planet, right? There's a lot of obvious solutions to that that just don't align with what the power structures want and what they benefit from. So they pretend those don't exist. And we go, you know, ESG, and we can still use oil and everything else because we're fighting for freedom. And it's a big contradictory situation, you know, that we need to recognize first and foremost how silly those all are. And then lean into things that we think actually benefit the human species. That's right. What I think.
Well, like CO2 is a joke because that's like plant food, but there's pollution. It's so obvious. Species are going extinct. I mean, there's mm-hmm. It's so obvious. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what's really going on in Gaza. I know this is your passionate. You talk about it pretty much daily. And it's because the media is not giving us what's really going on. And I'd like to understand the bigger agenda behind this, but people need to understand what's going on a daily basis. I mean, they've just demolished these people's homes, yeah. Their hospitals. They're not letting food in. I just published an article that only 1-2% or 2-3% of the food trucks are actually getting in. Maybe that's changed over the last few days. I don't know. This is a dire situation. Now they're going to attack southern Gaza. Now what's happening with that? Can you just give us an overall of what's going on?
Yeah. I mean, that's a really, really hard thing to summarize, I'll generally give you what's on the top of my mind, but you know, feel free to ask any of the, I'll go into it for 5-20 minutes about any of these topics, because there's just so much to go over. And the hard thing with this topic is there's so many landmines around this where, you know, you're saying something that's already been like built up around, like, if you say this, you're a racist anti-Semite. And so like you get into these conversations in an objective way and talk about certain things that are true and easily verifiable. And it requires like another 5 minutes of explanation for people to recognize why that's not what they've said it was. Like, that's my point. It's so hard, but I'm happy to get into it because this is really important. And I would say that, you know, I've talked about this conversation, specifically the plight of the Palestinians, the Israel occupation, and the history around this that's verified by the UN and literally every international body. I've talked about it for a very long time. Now, I foreign policy is very important to me because this overlaps with just about every other aspect of the, in particular, domestic problems that Americans deal with. And the same point for Britons, you know, from the UK and the way their government acts, like their foreign policy comes directly back to us. But you know, when COVID-19 happened and a lot of other things, and I've also been very passionate about medical freedom and a lot of topics, anything I think is important, that I really got pulled into that. And I think and I think it was an important thing to do. What I think I'm seeing in this is that I think as my coverage progresses over years, that there becomes a kind of a focal point. And I cover a lot of other things that happen too. Right now, that's very clearly Gaza and Israel, because it is, in my opinion, the most important thing happening in the world. And I don't just mean because of how catastrophic it is, because of how the most obvious famine and genocide in our lifetime, but because it is so centrally connected to so many other things that people don't recognize. You know, and so that being said, I mean, there will be a time when I'm not talking about this every day is why I'm kind of saying that. But there's a reason I am, because it's important, you know. And so right now, what we're dealing with is a historical problem that goes back 75 plus years, far more than that when you understand the reality of Zionism as a political organization, where the Zionist grouping of political, which is not Judaism. That's the important part to understand. There's Jewish organizations around the world that are screaming at anybody who will listen, Orthodox Jewish groups in Israel as well, to get beat up by the IDF, which doesn't make sense unless you understand what's going on. that they're trying to tell you. Zionism is not Judaism. They do not represent every Jew in the world. Now, that's Orthodox Jewish community saying that in many cases. So my point is that don't think that Ryan's saying that. That's what a lot of Jewish people in the world think. So static, objective reality, right? That has to flavor that. You can't say then that Judaism is Zionism or that they do those things that represent all the Jews in the world if a lot of the Jews in the world don't think that. So why are they saying that, right?
Are you ready to take control of your health in today's toxic world? Look no further. Masterpiece is here, setting the gold standard for holistic detoxification. Masterpiece, the natural master binder, features nanosized zeolites combined with a marine plasma nutrition. And here's the groundbreaking news. In initial trial results, users have experienced an astonishing 70% removal of toxins after just 60 days of use. Say goodbye to forever chemicals and heavy metals. Masterpiece is a game changer, efficiently capturing graphene oxide, arsenic, mercury, and over 85 other heavy metals. Not to mention, it tackles forever chemicals like microplastics and PFAS, a group of over 4,700 man-made chemicals lurking in everyday products. Users are reporting incredible benefits: more energy, heightened mental clarity, and better sleep. One user happily exclaimed, "The mental fog is just gone." And the best part, Masterpiece is affordable. For just $52.99, you get a two-month supply that can transform your life. Visit sarahwessel.com under shop or click the link below to grab yours today. Don't keep this breakthrough to yourself. Spread the word to family and friends. Masterpiece is not just a product, it's a life changer. Act fast and get yours today at sarahwessel.com or with the link below.
And so this comes back to the origins of Zionism and what they were trying to accomplish. And this is the quickest way to explain this is to understand that the argument is this was a God-given concept. God said this was the state for the Jews and so on, when in reality, it was the British government that gave the Zionist organization this area called the Balfour Declaration, right? And the point being is because they were basically trying to pacify a group that was using terrorism to get what they want. And this is documented by the governments of the British government, the U.S. government, CIA documents, Zionist documents. They were bombing both the British. They were bombing Arab Jews all over the world. Avi Shalom was discussing this, and he has right until this very day. They were bombing Iraqi Jews to drive them into becoming the state of Israel. The point is, there's even a CIA document that I've covered where they say, on the record, that the Zionist organization was willing to sacrifice all the Jews in Arab countries just to achieve their state. There's documented history, both on Wikipedia, for crying out loud, but many other documented things that I think are more valid, where the Lehi faction of the Zionist group was trying to align itself with the Nazi Germany party, and did, in fact, well past the Final Solution. And this is something Dan Cohen has written about, which then makes no sense when you argue that the reason the state was created is to defend against that event that they were involved with to some degree during, not the event itself necessarily, but the group behind it. So all that's to say that that's the origin of taking Palestine, which before that, and Avi Shalom, who is a highly respected British Israeli historian, will tell you himself that they lived in harmony. Humans always have problems in their societies, but the point is they lived in reasonable harmony in the area until the Zionist government came and, as he describes it, as creating the territorial dimensions of Zionism, which became Israel. All this time later, after multiple Nakbas and ethnic cleansing and millions of people being murdered and killed over the years, just the first Nakba, I think it was 800,000 people were cleansed and displaced, that this is now this ongoing dilemma about, okay, it was taken from the Palestinians, and that's a historical reality. UN documents have always made this clear. This is an entirety of Palestine. Today, we focus on West Bank and Gaza. But the truth is, you go back to their documents, and I've just read one from 78 discussing the right of return for Palestinians, that this was all Palestine occupied, right? So now again, the debate becomes about Israel and the history around it and whether they were there for. The point is, international law was in place at that time, and the reality was Palestinians were present and they took it from them. So going forward, things have changed dramatically, where generation after generation of Israelis have been born, and people there, a lot of which don't have any stake in this, some of which speak up and say, "I don't agree with what's happening." That's important, not to broad stroke all Jews or all Israelis. It's not the truth, or even all IDF members. So now it comes to the two-state solution, where you're saying, okay, well, yes, all of that land is legally the Palestinians, but they even can acknowledge that it's unfair to displace the Israeli families just like they might have been before. So there comes the two-state solution. Now, the history there is that it's proven now, both from Netanyahu and others that have former Prime Minister Barak spoke on this in a public interview, they have funded Hamas billions of dollars, in fact, through Qatar to keep them in power in order to stop the Palestinian state that they pretended they wanted out publicly. So all of this is easy to prove today. And so it challenges and destroys their entire basis of all the historical stuff. Then it coming into just, let's just jump to post October 7th. The reality is there was no ceasefire in place. They were, you can look back and there was posts within like the weeks before October 7th where UNICEF said this is the deadliest year for Palestinian children in history. That was posted on, well, really weeks before that, but there was an article posted on the 6th. So it's a really stark point to show on the 6th. They're saying the most deadly year. So clearly they have been bombing and so on. But then, of course, we have the event of October 7th, and there's all sorts of very clear, provable admissions coming from their own people that they had multiple examples, warnings weeks ahead, months ahead from multiple countries. People even said, we see them training. We're trying to tell our supervisors, and they threatened us with prison time. That's on the record from Israeli media for trying to inform them that Hamas was going to do something. And remember, including that we know that they're funding and it overlaps there. Now, there's a hard situation there with Hamas because I think there's still some Israeli influence there to some degree, but I actually more think now that over the process of the last 20, you know, two decades or plus, that it has changed, that the resistance movement has more so influenced what Hamas is today. That's not to say I know for sure, but so then the event happens. Now, here's the important part that gets really hard for some people to wrap their mind around, and it's the truth, though. The Fourth Geneva Convention maintains that occupied territories, which again, every international body in the world acknowledges this is occupied, Gaza included, to this very day, they have a right to armed resistance, armed rebellion, armed struggle. They all apply to the same thing, which means they have the right to pick up a gun and go and attack the occupier, military targets, whether or not they were attacked first, which means by default, the Hamas operation was a legal act. Now, crimes that may have been committed around that, Hamas members raping, stealing, whatever you think might have happened, and there's no evidence for the raping conversation, or the proof, I should say, those would be crimes. And we have to hold them accountable for that. Children were provably taken back, which is a crime. And I've always maintained that. And somebody needs to be held accountable for that war crime, because that's what it is. Now, the act does not get invalidated. If we're going to make that argument, that means that every war in history is invalidated, which if you're going to make that claim, then it needs to be equal, right? Because the Iraq war is rife with rape and murder and torture and all sorts of things. So the argument still means that the war they claim was valid, but these things were crimes. The same thing applies here. So all this time since then, we've seen a genocide, an ongoing, nonstop, relentless act of continual, openly stated genocide with the direction of absolutely ethnically cleansing. Now, all those statements are directly taken from public statements by officials. The ICJ laid them all out. Sadly, a lot of people just don't want to hear it. But again, I think right now we're at a point where it's pretty much people that are blindly adherent to a Zionist agenda or somehow have a religious adherence to what they think they're supposed to support for Israel, and then like everybody else. And I've never seen that in my life before. It's just very crazy how obvious it is. And I think the reality is that they've shot themselves in both feet with doing what they did. Last point, then we can go any other direction, is that Israel, after October 7th, had they gone to the UN and said, we were attacked, this is wrong, they committed a crime, here's what happened. And even with all the lies we now know are provable lies, you know how much harder it would have been to get past those lies if they had introduced it in a legal way and then it was discussed and then they went forward? My point is they would have never had to ask for support again. Already had insurmountable support. That would have solidified it, in my opinion, forever. Instead, they went full Zionist and full genocide and immediately went to murdering children and everything they've done since, which then woke everybody up. All these average people are like, you can't just look, there's no narrative you can place over all the things we see and 15,000 children and everything else we see. And that you go, oh, that's why it makes sense. That doesn't exist. There's no narrative that makes us feel okay. And they can't come back from that, you know, and I think that's important. Now, there really are so many other angles that are important to get into, but I think that's a good understanding of what's going on, you know, and I think there's a lot of allegations of racism and anti-Semitism that get thrown over the top of this when the truth is what I'm doing. I think a lot of us, I'm fighting for Jewish people. I'm fighting for Muslims. I'm fighting for Israelis and Palestinians and anybody who is being suppressed and taken advantage of by power structures. And right now, Jewish people are rapidly recognizing that Zionism has been doing that for 75 years.
That's right. So they are still digging in their heels, though. And what is going on? Well, they moved everybody from the northern part of Gaza to the southern part of Gaza. They told people that's where you can be safe. And now they're attacking the southern part of Gaza where people have nowhere to go. No food is coming in, or little food is coming in. People are starving. Children are starving. Are they still bombing and attacking southern Gaza at this? I know they've done some campaigns there. Are they doing it as we speak today?
Yes. Yes. Well, I'm glad you said that. So you had asked about aid, too, and I do want to comment on that. And so what's important, though, is the so right now it's not everybody. There are hundreds of thousands, as I understand it, of people still in the north, kind of scattered in different groupings, but they're there. And they're the ones that are catastrophically starving. Like, so the IPC and then the other group, I'm blanking on the name. They're the two leading groups in the world that are the ones that come out and, like, using a metric graded scale, decide whether things are famine, starvation, food insecurity, right? And so right now they've given the North a level 5 catastrophe, the highest possible level. And this is not from some secondary related information that they have. This is their vetted process, and they're going, these people are starving to death, famine level. You know, I mean, what that means is, like, and these are numbers that have even reported by the corporate media, 90% of Palestinians are not being able to get fed every day. They can't find food every day. Most of them are so food insecure that they're borderline at the level 5 famine, and that's where North is right now. Nobody even sees most of what's happening there, and they're there, and they're being attacked regularly, and there's also a lot of conversations that I can't truly verify coming from Israeli high-level individuals, both within the government and not, that are claiming that the people in the north are not only being starved, but are then being engaged with in some weird political process where they're demanding that they refute basically disregard their UNRWA status and say on a film that I am no longer a refugee. I have no right to my home back in the area you now occupy. And it's like, this is reported by somebody with standing. And so it's like, it's just clear what they're doing. Now, the South, and it's important to note too, that as they've moved from the North to the South, every single time, and I mean that provably, every single time they said, move here, that's going to be safe. Even Egypt, even corporate media reported as it happened. They bombed the place they were leaving from. They bombed the route to the new place, and they bombed the new place. Every single time, video, testimony, corporate human rights groups. I mean, it's so overwhelming. And the point is, like, at least 4 or 5 times I can prove, and Khan Yunis was the last one. They bombed Khan Yunis. Now they're going, you know, they went to Rafah. They bombed Khan Yunis on the way and to Rafah. Now they're saying, we're going to come up with a plan to move you somewhere from Rafah. And in the meantime, we're just bombing Rafah. I don't know how that's not the most ridiculous thing in the world, how Biden can pretend like we need some kind of plan and that acts like we're in some kind of limbo state. And so they're in an area they were told to go because they said it would be safe. And then they're just bombing into Rafah with no justification. It happens. I mean, these are the kind of things that, like I said, are shaking the average person free. There's not even attempted narratives at that. They just go human shields, Hamas, you know, whatever. There's no verification. And on that note, remember that even the international community has said that if you're going to claim human shields, hospital, school, whatever, you have to prove that. It's not, you don't just say that and we have to pretend we assume that. If you haven't proven and produced evidence, then that's as if it's not happening. That was from the United Nations. But of course, because UN is Hamas, who cares, right? It's ridiculous.
Well, there's I'm sure you've seen it. You've probably published it. The video of the 4 teenage boys that were walking that just get their unarmed that were bombed by a drone. How can they even, those kinds of things going on, they can't, there's no defense to it. It's just, that's what you're saying. So, okay. One of the things that really triggers me, it really bothers me, is that when the media makes an argument that nobody wants the Palestinians, Egypt doesn't want them, nobody in the area wants them. It's like, well, this was their home. Why should another country take them in? I mean, I don't, when you hear that excuse, what do you think? Because that's kind of an ongoing theme right now.
It's insulting. It's racist. But blatantly, let me realize what's the premise of what they're saying. Like Eli David and these, you know, constant propagandists in this conversation, they do this 3 times a day. Well, they'll show the image of the wired fence in Egypt and they go, why don't they want them? Why wouldn't they take them? You know, and it's like, so you're obviously suggesting, well, because they know they're as disgusting as we think they are, like, or that they're as dangerous as we think they are, or they're as, like, whatever it is, you're clearly in trying to insinuate very clumsily that they're all disgusting, not just Hamas, but all of them. And so, I mean, that's implicit in what he's saying. And so, which is disgusting and racist and shows you the kind of hatred that they carry for all of them while trying to pretend they're fighting for the innocent Palestinians. So what's important to realize, as you pointed out, is that it's not Egypt's responsibility to take the people that are then going to be a burden on their society, which that's not to be an insult. Any grouping of a million people is going to be a burden on a society that's built around, their current population. That's an influx of even the same ethnicity and religion is going to be taxing on society, let alone a group that doesn't assimilate exactly in exactly the same way. Now, obviously, there are probably a much easier overlap to Egypt in this regard, but nonetheless, it's not their responsibility. And I'm not defending Sisi specifically and Egypt's government in general, because they don't have the best record at all in regard to how they've dealt with the Palestinians. But the Egyptian people aggressively support the Palestinians and very clearly don't want to support Israel. That's the whole normalization push that they did to try to manipulate all this from the government level. But the point is that he's basically spoken and said that they don't want to leave, and they don't. The lie they tried to spin in the beginning by claiming Hamas was keeping them there. It only takes a couple hundred videos of Palestinians going like, "This is my homeland. I'm born here. I've been displaced 3 times. I'm gonna die here." And the point is that resonates with most Americans. Going like, "Well, what do you think a Republican would do if they were in that position?" Right? I think it was Dave Smith that made this argument in an interview where he's going like, imagine the reverse, where all of a sudden China takes over the government or the country and puts us in a camp in the middle of California. Like, what do you think Republicans would be doing? Probably be attacking, probably fighting for their freedom, and it would be a legal fight, and they'd probably be yelling something about God when they did it, right? It's just weird. We don't recognize how the similarities are there, But the last point was just that I think that all these countries are actively trying to stand up in defense of the reality of what this all comes back to, which is what I mentioned, the right of return. UNRWA is the only group that is there managing the records of where they're supposed to be allowed to go back to. And this is what comes back to the occupation, international law, and why they're so aggressively trying to hide that central point. Because in the legal structure of a war, taking territory in some cases is legal in the context of a war. But once that war is over, you're supposed to be relinquishing and letting people come back to that territory, which is what even Israel agreed to more than once, in fact, in previous discussions with the UN, and they just never did it. And now they're pretending like it doesn't exist, while here they are taking video going, renounce is the word I was looking for, renounce your status as a refugee, And so Egypt is saying they have a right to that territory. And then it circles back to undermining the very premise of what Israel is, and you see why they're defensive against it. But it's important. It's legality and human rights.
Well, UNRWA, let's talk about that for a little bit. They made this big thing that UNRWA is so bad because they're funneling money and stealing the aid and everything else. So now they just cut off UNRWA and didn't replace it with anything else. Go over that because that is one of the other things that the mainstream media is convincing people who aren't looking past stuff.
Yeah. So to your earlier question about the amount of aid, that's a really difficult percentage to understand because there's so many vying narratives, and most of them are lies. The truth is we're dramatically less than what we ever saw before October 7th. And there's lies about this circulating. I just proved it last night. In fact, pre-October 7th, there was about 500 minimum average. The point was at that time, even with 500 average trucks a day, humanitarian aid in general, they were already food insecure. So they were already in a dangerous position. Today, we're dramatically less than that. Even by Elon Levy's numbers, who was the spokesman that got fired recently, he was claiming that this number, there were 20,000 trucks we've had since October 7th. See, they're not starving. But you do the math, that's about 112 a day. So it's easy to see that that's a fifth generally of what they were getting of all humanitarian aid before October 7th, and they were already insecure. Now we're at level of famine. So even the point is that even 500 is not enough at this point. They need to be going over 1,000 a day to just meet their needs. And then on top of that, we see the evidence of them, their settlers having raves and blocking food, right? And making sure, and then Mossad praising them for doing it, and Israel praising them for blocking the aid or shooting the aid as they come in, which every aid group, World Food Program, UNRWA, I mean, everyone, they've admitted, you shot at us. We saw you shoot at us while we brought this in, or shooting people trying to get the aid. Even just yesterday from the World Kitchen, or what is it, the World, I'm like a World Central Kitchen, I think, is a group of aid workers. There was multiple, I think it was Canadian, Australian. They just got bombed by Israel. And Israel today came out and said, "We apologize. It was an accident," because I made this point last night. Because these weren't just average workers that are overlapping with UNRWA. These were foreign entities from Australia and Canada. Am I correct on Canada? These are the governments that are now going to be forced to speak up and go, "You just killed one of our citizens." Not a Palestinian Canadian, but a Canadian that was there working and they all should matter the same. But I think that's really important to see. And so they just kill these people in plain daylight. And so it's obvious that they are just targeting aid on top of all of that. And so it becomes this kind of like, as somebody framed it, as like this Hunger Games scenario where you know that you put them in a position where they're like ravenous to the point to where literally children are dying every day, like in that moment. So imagine being a father going up to an aid truck where you have, you know, two crates, 100 bags of flour, and you've got 10,000 people rushing to get some food. Oh, and you know that if you don't get one of those bags, your child's going to die tonight. What do you think you would do? What do you think you would do to your neighbor? You know what I'm saying? Like the point where you're like, I don't know what to do. I have to. And so they're creating a situation where they're pitting them against each other. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying that's horrible. Keep going.
Okay. Well, and then I wanted to talk about you asked about the aid workers in general and, you know, the overlap of all of that. And I think what's important to see is that they are clearly targeting these people in order to create a situation where, back to UNRWA, where they act like it's their fault, even though they're the ones targeting them. And this is one of the most easy to see dynamics is they go, okay, Hamas controls everything, which, by the way, let's remember, they did that on purpose. They funded them to create that dynamic, forced the Palestinians, whether they wanted to or not. Quite frankly, I question the legitimacy of the 2005 election. I don't know why Israel would let them vote while they're calling them terrorists. That seems kind of silly to me. But let's just pretend they did. It wasn't all of them. It was only a plurality. It was 46%, I think. The point is, they forced all of the Palestinians to engage with Hamas. So then, over the process of decades, well, of course you're going to find cards and overlapping systems where they that was the government. So whether or not you agreed with them or not, hospitals and whatever else, they were forced to kind of deal with them in some way. Doesn't mean they were all working with Hamas. And so the problem is that they then say, well, then UNRWA is Hamas because there's overlaps with that. The point is that then they started shooting anybody that was involved with the aid process, police, UNRWA, whatever else, because they said, well, they're Hamas. Okay. So they shot them. So that means either they weren't dead or they were now afraid to do it. Then all of a sudden there was a situation where they weren't there and they go, well, they're not there now. Now there's nobody helping the aid. So it's their fault. So it's like, okay, so no matter what they do, you're going to kill them or they're not there and it's their fault. Even though overall, whether UNRWA is present or not, it is Israel's fault to maintain security over the delivery of that aid. And that, what do? They shoot people when they get the aid and blame it on them for being hungry. All of this is proven by just about every international body in the world. And yet, the U.S. government still lets it continue.
Well, they're in control of the territory. So who was it that the Australian journalist that wrote the article about, excuse me, and I know you know who she is. Her name escapes me. How said, what would you do if genocide happened? Now you know. You know, what would you do during World War II or another genocide if it was happening? What would you do? Well, now you know, because what are you doing now with what's going on with Gaza?
Exactly. And that's such a powerful moment. And it, for overlap, like Jonathan Glazer in his speech at the Oscars after the Holocaust movie, you know, it's like the point is there a lot of these people are very aware, uncomfortably aware with the parallels between the Holocaust, Nazi Germany, World War II, and what we're watching, and to the point to where it's undeniable. And so that's the first question we now know to the article and to your point, what would we have done? Well, whatever you're doing right now, there's your answer, right? Are you standing up? Are you fighting for these people? Or are you meekly backing in and taking the acceptable narrative because it's politically advantageous for you, right? Or because whatever else, you know, brown shirts and all these arguments from that time frame, there's a lot of that happening right now and people that I never would have expected. So we need to remember that going forward. But to the point about the Oscars, remember, he made a movie, a documentary about the Holocaust, a very powerful one. And he then went up and spoke at the Oscars after winning the award and didn't refute his Jewishness in the way they tried to frame it. What he actually said was he refutes the way that they're weaponizing his Jewishness. And, you know, he doesn't believe, basically, it's the Zionism and Judaism point that we just made, right? He came out, he called that out. What'd they do? They proved him right by saying, well, then you're not a Jew. Oh, really? So Zionists get to decide who is and isn't a Jew? Like, that's the point we're trying to make. And so these people they can't deny this. And what I see it as is whether or not they believe in Zionism or whatever else and anything in between, Jonathan Glazers of the world like that, they just have morality. Whether you agree with them or not, anything else, like in that moment, he could not bear to not say that, at least I understand it. There could be other intentions I don't know about, but that to me, it seems he just wasn't okay. He wouldn't live with himself if he didn't stand up and say, I don't support this and I don't want my name being a part of that. You know, and I see it as integrity. And that's what I think we're fighting with right now is there's party lines and, you know, disagreements on COVID and everything else. But right now people are like, that's genocide. And that's important to work with, even if we don't agree on everything else, you know?
I agree. So where do you think Zionism is going? I see the world is waking up to this. Are we seeing a breakdown of Zionism and a new way of looking at the world? Is Zionism done?
Yeah, I mean, I doubt, and really this is the same concept that people are talking about in regard to Hamas and anything else, is you can't, you know, violently remove an ideology. Like, that's
sure,
not how that works. Usually you grow it when you do something like that. And so, I mean, realistically, it's always going to be there. Sadly enough, and I say that because, you know, and obviously maybe this is my lack of objectivity. You guys can decide for yourselves, but I find it really difficult to broad stroke just about anything. And my experience and how much I've engaged with this, I don't see very many Zionists that aren't in like lockstep with what they're talking about. And so for me and my experience thus far, I don't see any positive side to this. And this is where I reference again, somebody like Avi Shalom, a highly respected Israeli British historian, who says blatantly, Zionism is racism. And he goes over from an academic side of this and goes, well, they've got the what's called the nation state law that literally states this is the state for the Jews alone. Right. And there was even an example of this. I publicly share this on the show all the time, where it was a TV broadcaster trying, like we see on internet, on the online right now, defend, no, Arabs have equal rights. It's all, everything's the same here. Netanyahu came out and said, you're wrong. Like, this is what's quoted in Haaretz. No, he says, it's the state for the Jews alone. And then somehow we're supposed to pretend like that's not the case. It's willful ignorance from people in power, that's one of the most alarming things people are coming to terms with, is we're in a really bad situation when we can see that clearly, how morally ambiguous, if not sociopathic, like all of these power structures are for allowing this or not caring, you know?
That's right.
But I think Zionism is on the way out for sure. I think it's very obvious that whatever what they did with their, I guess, either being overly, you know, their hubris, or like believing that they would just, nobody would push back and they could go this far, or just didn't care. I don't know. But what they did opened everybody's eyes. And this is going to forever, like, let's put it this way. The way people talk about Holocaust and World War II, about, you know, Nazis, that's going to be Zionism in 30 years. That's not an insult. That's not racist. It's a political ideology, and it's a reality of what they're doing, you know. And you can disagree with the severity of what I'm saying, but to try to pretend that therefore means I hate Jewish people, it's just insulting. And it's because of the overuse of that against people that don't feel that way, that they're making it actually more unsafe for Jewish people.
That's right. It's for Jewish, and Jewish people need to be separated out from Zion. Even though a large portion are Jewish, there's all sorts of Christians and other people that are Zionists, and they need to split that out. Now, let's relate the Zionist ambition to what's going on in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's the relation. Is it separate? Yeah. What is the deal?
It's really interesting, actually. And this is where it gets into, it's bigger than just, it feels like a much larger story. For, I mean, almost everything, like when we talk about the bio labs or the information around foreign policy or Azov movement and the domestic conversation from what happened to Charlottesville and all these connections. The point is that the Azov movement is a, you know, let's also, in case you're on, I'm sure you guys probably know, but 2014 forward, the coup that took place, which is, again, embarrassingly on the record, when we have Nuland on a recording pan picking who is going to be in the Democratic election, you know, or any number of examples where, you know, for a fact, or Kathy Ashton from EU on the record with somebody from Estonia saying that they know that it was actually their people who shot people at the protest and they just didn't, you know, it's all on the record. The point is, 2014 forward, this was a US backed coup of Ukraine. And so, and Israel involved, because we can show provably that they were funding the Azov movement, which is a neo-Nazi group. In 2018, Haaretz wrote an article saying human rights groups are asking Israel why they're funding neo-Nazi groups. Well, for people watching the show now have some understanding, because we just talked about the Zionist and Nazi overlap. There is something to that. And so they've been funding this group for a long time. Now, the CIA has been doing the same. It goes back even as far as you look, really, I think 1948 and before, called Operation Aerodynamic. And I've talked about this a lot. The documents are public today, where they funded a guy named Michael Lebed, who was an actual Nazi war criminal. They used the group called the Organization for Ukrainian Nationalists, a very openly fascist organization. They bled into these groups. They put up Michael Lebed, who again is a Nazi war criminal, in New York with a media company. So think about it, as an American, your government taking a Nazi and going, here, influence them with your own opinions. Like, that's just crazy, but also in Ukraine. So all that's to say that that was the basis for what became, you know, the Right Sector, Svoboda, all these neo-Nazi offshoots of what they were growing there. Then, ostensibly with the attention to manipulate the Soviet Union. So all the way forward, we now have the overlap with what they were doing in Ukraine with all sorts of other things, with the Rise Above movement that was the marching group in Charlottesville. Remember, that was the whole time. That was the beginning of the whole MAGA white supremacy. That's where that all really began. That they will not replace us, that whole march, right? That was on the record, and I can prove it with documentation and statements online, the U.S. arm of the Azov movement. How ridiculous is that, right? That's a provable reality. And so the point is that they were marching, they even met in Ukraine to discuss the overlap. The point is that that then is a clear tie back to a CIA-funded, Israel-funded proxy army that is now being seeded in the United States. What do? They tried to blame it on Russia. And on January 6th, they had Azov movement members on the record there being filmed with Jake Chansley and on record, on film, running in, going, go, run in, you know, go into the Capitol in Russian. The guy's, his name is Sergei Dubinin. He's a Ukraine Azov movement member, is Ukrainian, screaming things in Russian. And what was the whole narrative that Russia was somehow seeding? The point was they were trying to create a, in my opinion, a false flag to blame people based on the idea that it was Russia seeding white supremacy, when all they did was create it to blame Russia and everybody else, including you, America. And so all that's to say that that's partly Zionism, partly whatever you want to call the CIA intelligence, United States government apparatus, trying to create the narratives to control what they would want. And realize they're talking about Russia, Iran, Syria as some kind of axis. So all of this is aimed in the same kind of general direction. And this is my point about how important this story is, that just directs everything. Like, it connects with so many important things. And really, as far back as you want to look, in the context of when Zionism existed, this has been what they've done. Terrorism rewarded over and over and over throughout history.
Yeah, it's incredible. Okay, let's talk about your combats, your organization, and how you've been dealing with, because you've been talking about this. This goes against the government narrative. It goes against the power structure, what you've been reporting, and you and many others are making a dent. You know, I'd like to think some of the stuff I did is making a difference, but the censorship is showing not only on Twitter, which we can talk about, and other platforms, but you're also under attack by lawsuits, and it's affected your ability to maintain your journalists. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because I'm hoping people in my audience will, if you have a little bit of extra funds, they can support you. But please talk about what's going on.
Well, thank you for that. Yeah, it's something we recently started to give Send Go. I believe it's givesendgo.com/savetlav. And the whole point is that in the last month, and a little before that, we've always been, as you know, wildly censored. I mean, you name the platform, we've been kicked off of it twice. And the point is, it's not for some kind of, you know, broken. The argument they state for why they removed me is something you can prove I didn't even do. You know, it's typically some kind of misinformation allegation, or today it's more like supporting violent organizations. That I keep getting that one, and I'm like, what? Like, I'm exposing, like, I'm highlighting what they're doing over here is wrong, and then I'm not alternatively going like, yay, praise Hamas. I'm not, in fact. Like, I actually worried because of the Israel influence there whether I should, yet they still pretend I'm supporting violence. It's crazy. But censored everywhere, right? And so on top of all of that, and the suppression, which is also huge, Twitter is a huge part of that we got. It was in 1 month I got about, it was, well, technically about a month and a half time frame. There were two separate lawsuits that we got leveled at TLAV specifically as the company entity the only connected point is the same lawyer. And so to me, I thought that was pretty ridiculous. But, you know, the bottom line was, it is costing money for me to have to fight this. Otherwise, well, I can't get into all the details, and I would love to explain this, and I promise I will. My point is, my lawyer is very explicit about the fact that, because it looks like we're going to have to go to trial, which drives me crazy. Time, money, it's infuriating. But the point is that we may say something now that could be used against us because they're clearly watching what TLAV is doing and so on. So the point being, what I can tell you is that they're being sued. I'm being sued. TLAV is being sued from two different separate things to the same lawyer. What I argue is wildly flimsy, which hopefully I can win in the court of law, that ultimately is about my lawyer argues it does not seem like they're actually doing this for what he might expect. The point is that they're clearly ambulance chasers, or like the trolls, where they throw these letters at everyone they can in hopes that you're just going to settle and make some money. But what's weird about it is that we went in and engaged, trying to go like, well, you know, I'm not going to pay these people off, but maybe they can come to some kind of small settlement. And they don't seem like they even care about that. It seems like they're bent on going to court, which seems like the opposite of what we expect from them. I found entire articles about this law firm Like, it's obvious that's what they do. They're like, just try to trick people into giving them payouts, right? And so then that makes me feel like this is about more than that. Like, yep. Try, like somebody, like, again, why is it the same lawyer? How does that make sense? And so I don't know, but it makes me think this is about somebody trying to either that he doesn't like what I'm doing, or that they've been put to the work against trying to take money, my time. I don't know. Now, let's just say all that's not true. Nonetheless, I'm still got to go through this. So we have to pay the lawyer to go through the process. And it's just infuriating because I feel like this is frivolous. And so the campaign was set up to help me support keeping this at bay, because the reality is it could end up being something that ends up taking away TLAV. And on the other side of it, at the same month, and this is what really made me trigger this, quite frankly, because I feel like this is connected. And it's just my opinion. But at the same time, I got a crazy series of letters from the IRS claiming that I owe $30,000, in fact, from an old, like, 2012 return, which the point was, and rightly so, people are saying, well, that's outside whatever they call it, the statute of limitations or whatever. Their argument is somehow that they've been telling me about this and that I've been withhold, like, not been following up, which that's not my accountant, myself. I've never seen this. Now, I had some other smaller ones that I was engaging with. And so I don't know what's going on there. And overall, they're now threatening to levy my assets, which, what's that? That's TLAV. I don't really have any other assets. So it's hard for me not to stand back and go, okay, in a very short period of time, I've got multiple lawsuits directly aimed at my business for frivolous things from people that are acting uncharacteristically, according to my lawyer. Then I got the IRS at the same time coming at me personally. I find that to be hard to understand. But either way, whether it's all they justified their mind or not, it's all amounting to immediately affecting what I can do with this platform, because it's money that my point was, I had to pay off some amount of that they were demanding, or they were going to start to try to levy my assets, and I don't want to go through that process. So thank God for our support in the community, that we had a really resounding first month on the fundraiser, and I was able to deal with them at least in the moment, and we're going through the process, which, again, sadly, it looks like I'm going to go to court for at least the first one, because the other one is further down the line. And it's just, it takes my time, you know? And so thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about that and the support from your audience and so on, because I think we're all dealing with this, whether this is that or not. Like, for instance, Dr. Mercola and his website, remember what happened to him? He got his bank shut down, his bank account shut down, and it wasn't just him and his personal and for his business. They then shut down the bank accounts of his COO, of the children of his COO. I'm just like, I mean, how in the world do we not see that? Or the trucker convoy. Like, it's so clear that this is beginning to happen, and they're coming at us in really unique ways, because we're threatening, you know, it's that we're seeing it. We're making a difference, and they don't know how to stop that. And I think that's what this amounts to.
Yeah, I wrote an article called Being Unpersoned in America and all the ways that I've been attacked. And it's just relentless. But how can people support you? I mean, you have a give, send, go. Where do they go? And what is it that you need?
Well, really, first and foremost, share the work. Share your work, share my work, share what we're talking about. Get it out there. Make sure people are talking about it. Over anything else, that's what I constantly want, because that's what they want to stop, right? Have discussions, have groups. Like, I want people to make little weekly community parties from your neighborhood and sit down and talk about what we're discussing, you know, like, and disagree with us. You know, like, we want more critical thinking. That's what's important. But if you're interested in supporting TLAV, or Sarah, for that matter, if you want to support, reach out through the different channels that we have. And for me personally, I have the Give, Send, Go we created. And for me, what that's about is trying to create a recurring following, right? So we had an amazing overflow of support for that first month. But my point with that one in particular was to try to get to a few more $1,000 a month on, like, a recurring basis. That way I can have that set. Do I know that's coming guaranteed? And I can allot that for certain things over here, and then maintain, like, the funding for, you know, we put out thousands of $1,000s a month for writing, for the work that we do, for, you know, Derek and Whitney and Robert and Matt Arrett and all these different people that write for us. And I was forced to kind of pull that back, you know, at least pause for the moment. So that's an obvious one to do it. GiveSendGo.com/SaveTLAV. But we have our Subscribestar, Buy Me a Coffee. My direct mailing address is on there. A portal right on the website, TheLastAmericanVagabond.com. You can go right there and do it. But, you know, I know people are struggling right now. That's part of the design as well. You know, it's really just about the support and, you know, thinking critically and continuing to ask questions, because that's what they're afraid of.
Well, thank you so much, Ryan. Thanks for having the courage to keep doing this. It's so important that people have the courage. And I agree with you 100% that people need to get in their neighborhoods, their friends, their communities, and talk about these things. That's where change is going to occur.
I agree. Well, thanks for having me on. I enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you, Ryan.